Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Christopher Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, could be worse, I suppose.
Well, that's a very upbeat...
Mustn't grumble.
...way to begin.
I will. I'm going to spend the next half hour grumbling.
It won't escape the notice of listeners that there's no third guest today because of the fact that there's been a lot that's happened in the whole nanny state world over the past couple of weeks, Chris, while you've been away. So we thought we'd use this opportunity to make the most of your expertise as the UK's leading merry warrior against all this nanny state miserabilism.
Bon vivant.
Before we get into any of that, though, we've got a big announcement to make, haven't we, Chris?
We certainly have.
So on the Saturday, the 19th of October, and Sunday, the 20th of October, is the Battle of Ideas Festival, Britain's premier ideas and politics festival. It happens Westminster every year. You and I have been involved in it for many years.
Many, many years.
And for the second year running, Last Orders is having a very special live edition of this podcast. It's on the Saturday, the 19th. It's going to be at 12:15, and it's going to be in a much bigger room than last year. Such was the success of the Last Orders podcast last year. They've given us a much bigger room, which we are really keen to fill. You can also, if you come along to the festival, see all of your favourite Spiked writers. Many people from the IEA are always there. It's a great weekend of discussion and debate. So please do come along. Listeners to this podcast, readers of Spiked in general, can also get a 20% discount on their tickets. You can get a ticket for the Saturday if you want to come and see Last Orders. You get a ticket for the Sunday as well, or a weekend ticket.
Get the whole ticket, I think.
Come for the whole weekend.
You can see me the following day, 10 a.m., talking about George Orwell. That'd be thinly attended, I would have thought, at that time of day.
He's quite obscure author, really, so...
It was more at 10 o'clock in the morning.
There is
it's
that.
A bit early after a night at the Battle of Ideas. It's early for me, but I'm going to try my best to be there.
That's
listeners, so come along and maybe join me.
Also on Sunday, even more importantly, the Spiked podcast is going to have its live edition as
well. Even more importantly?
Well, to me.
Equally important.
Equally importantly. Okay, let's be diplomatic about this. But anyway, please go to... So please do come along. Go to battleofideas.org.uk. And if you're a listener to this podcast, if you're a Spiked fan, you can use your 20% discount by using the code SPIKED24. That's SPIKED 24 at checkout to get your discount.
And we will have some guests that time.
We have. We've already got two confirmed guests, in fact.
Two top guests.
Julia Hartley Brewer of Talk fame.
Kate Andrews, TV's Kate Andrews.
TV's Kate Andrews, also the Spectator's Kate Andrews, formerly the
Spectator
IA, of course.
Spectator TV's Kate Andrews.
Exactly. She's all across all the platforms and she will be on that panel on the Saturday. So please do come along. Chris, you've just also got finished debating Peter Hitchens about one of the many things you two have clashed about over the years, Lucy Letby. How was that?
Pretty good. Hopefully by the time this comes out, it'll be available. The Daily Mail recorded it. There's over an hour's worth of content there about what supposedly is like one of the hot issues of the day. It probably won't change your mind, listener, whichever way you lean on this one, because nothing ever does, but it's quite entertaining. So check it out.
Definitely. And if listeners are wondering why we didn't fight tooth and nail to have that debate on this podcast, we did try, but quite understandably, Hitchens was loyal to
his employer.
His employer. So we look forward to watching.
He's
that
a company
debate.
Man.
He is.
To the
He's
bitter
nothing
end.
If not loyal. So, Chris, let's talk about the nanny state, Keir Starmer's nanny state. Since we last did the podcast, our habit of sometimes recording these a few days before they go out bit us in the arse again.
Yeah, again.
Because...
Well, we had no choice, to be fair, because I was going to Portugal on holiday.
Exactly. It all revolves around your holiday, basically, unfortunately, in this case. But Keir Starmer has made clear his intentions where the nanny state is concerned. We should start with the smoking ban. His call to extend the smoking ban beyond inside... buildings, inside pubs, inside nightclubs.
Into outdoor smoking areas.
Absolutely.
We're going to ban smoking in outdoor smoking areas.
Places where non-smokers tend to gather in large numbers. So pub gardens obviously been a focus, but as you say, smoking areas outside nightclubs, sections of the pavement, presumably. I mean, this hasn't been a worked out policy yet, but it was one of those things that was originally leaked and he just instantly leaned into it, which shows that it's almost certainly going to come to pass at some point. Obviously, this has been talked about a lot, but what's your opening thoughts, I guess, about this? And because it did come as a bit of a shock.
It came as a huge shock. My first day on holiday, and suddenly I start reading rumours that they're going to ban smoking in smoking areas. I honestly thought it was the Sun exaggerating. I couldn't see them doing it. It's such an assault on the pub trade, apart from anything else. You know, it's absolutely going to wreck, not just pubs, bingo halls, casinos, anywhere where people gather, basically. And I think I predicted on this podcast before the Labour Party won its landslide that they were going to be a very, very nanny state government, because I think Starmer is genuinely committed to what he calls prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And so is streeting. But I did not expect this. I expected them to do the, you know, Sunak prohibition and clamp down on vapes in some way, but not this. And it was, in a way, it was the justification for it that was even more depressing than the policy, you know, because there was no pretense about this being, we need to protect bar workers from outdoor smoke, or we need to protect children from this and that, or we need to regulate the tobacco industry. All the excuses I've used down the years for all these other basically paternalistic policies, they've always pretended they're not actually paternalistic, you know? They've always pretended, oh, no, we're just regulating the industry or protecting various groups of people. And there's none of that this time. I mean, Starmer just basically said, we want people to stop smoking. This is a good way to make them stop smoking. If you can't smoke anywhere, then you'll at least cut down the number of tabs you smoke. Which, of course, you don't need to, you know, look peer too far down the slippery slope to see where that takes you. I mean, the guy just came out and said, my starting point on this is that 80,000 people die every year from smoking. So, well, yeah, but they're adults. So, you know, they kind of take the risks into account, don't they? You know, all along the line, right up until less, it's still less than a year since Sunak proposes bloody prohibition. It's amazing. Feels a lot longer. But up until a year ago, all the anti-smoking groups would say, yeah, obviously, if you're an adult and you want to smoke, then that's your choice. And that's changed now, thanks to Sunak. And this is where it leads you straight away. Is it leads you to this, like, we're going to just push you around for your own good.
Yeah.
And that's what is particularly dire about it. I just dread to think what's going to happen if they really go ahead with it. I'd like to think that it would be impossible to enforce in practice. I mean, imagine trying to enforce a ban on smoking shisha bars down the edge of our road, you know, or middle of Birmingham. I mean, they have tried it in some particularly nasty parts of the world, haven't they? Bits of Australia and bits of California, I think, have this sort of thing. But they don't really have a proper pub culture. And they probably have, well, they do have fewer smokers. So I don't know, but it's just another, you know, I was abroad when it happened and it just made me think I need to just permanently move abroad.
Basically. Just stay in Portugal, don't come back.
I love Portugal. I'd stay there. They've got a lot of rules in Portugal, but they don't seem to obey them, which is probably the best way of being.
Absolutely. I mean, and that point about how the old arguments against, or for these policies rather, just weren't really even made in this case, because how could you? I mean, the original smoking ban, and we could get into whether or not this was true or not, but the original smoking ban, as you say, was entirely made basically on the point of secondhand smoke, an area which has always been much more contested than people would like to let on. But nevertheless, no one credible was suggesting that being within a meter of a lit cigarette outside is a problem for anyone, unless you're all stood in a puddle of petrol at the time. Like, it's not a big problem, and anyone could recognise that. There's obviously the healthcare argument, but as you pointed out many times over the years, there's a string of evidence that's pretty clear now, which suggests that whether you're talking about just healthcare costs, but all healthcare costs combined with social security in general, smokers, by dint of not living as long, tend to save you money.
And paying a lot of tax,
So is it? So how do they then make this case that it's preventative then? Because as you say, that has been the point they've been making.
Well, what I read, there was something, it could be rubbish, but it was something in the New Statesman, so perhaps it was, by George Eaton, so it may well have been. But he said that Starmer genuinely believes this prevention stuff. And he thinks
the preventative state.
The preventative state,
which is terrifying.
Oh, my word, Yeah, he really believes that, you know, the only way to keep the NHS going is by forcing people to live healthier lives.
Yeah.
Which, for reasons you've just kind of alluded to, is really not true most of the time. And supposedly, Starmer believes this because it's sort of an extension of his belief about crime, which is you're better off putting money into schemes that stop people becoming criminals, whatever they may be, rather than building prisons. Now, it may well be true that it probably is true that preventing crime is more cost effective than punishing it. Bound to be, isn't it? But, you know, assuming these crime prevention policies work, and they may not do, but I mean, in principle, if these crime prevention policies work, then you've got people who would commit crimes otherwise not committing crimes. Whereas if the health policies work, you don't have people not dying. You just have people dying at an older age, having cost more.
And I suppose, crucially, crimes are something that people do to other people as well, rather than something that they're doing to themselves.
Yes, well, indeed, yeah. Although I suppose the argument about the NHS is you're kind of doing something to other people by costing them more money, but that doesn't stack up. In fact, it's the opposite of the truth. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether these things are true or not. If that's what they believe, then God help us, because the preventive state could obviously be very far-reaching indeed.
So in a sense, this is a problem of ideology. I mean, we saw a lot of the politics of lifestyle, the sort of nanny state on steroids, arriving with New Labour, the smoking ban. And there did seem to be a kind of relationship between politicians of the kind of technocratic quote-unquote centre, who were less and less interested in, say, you know, setting interest rates at the Bank of England, giving the Bank of England independence and so on. But they suddenly wanted to nationalise, you know, the smoking policies of all pubs. And is this just a kind of case of ideology that either you've got politicians who don't have a tremendous amount of vision, so they try and make up for it by obsessing over us?
Oh, I think completely. I mean, that was what Sunak was all about, really, wasn't it? And Theresa May. Yeah, and Starmer so far has really just been continuity Sunak, except more money for the unions.
Yeah.
You know, higher taxes, more money for unions. You can't complain. It is the Labour Party at the end of the day. It's not surprising they would put up taxes to give the unions more money. It's slightly surprising that they are already, after 2 months, resorting to Sunak / May type, you know, nanny state policies, which you can almost see why someone like Sunak at the fag end of 14 years of not very successful government might reach for something like the generational ban to try and give him a legacy. You would hope that Starmer would try and get on with some things first before he reaches for a legacy. And the original smoking ban was just Blair looking for a legacy. A legacy didn't involve killing lots of people in Iraq. So there's always a bit of desperation to these things. And it seems that the new government is already a bit desperate, which is pretty worrying. I mean, I'm just glad that young people are going to see that the Labour Party isn't any better than the Tories. You know, I think it's important that everyone realises that they're all as bad as each other. And I think it's going to be quite a long 5 years. And what's going to happen at the end of it when people are completely disillusioned with both main parties? I don't know.
Before we move on from smoking, it's worth, first of all, reminding people that this is obviously not going to be the full extent of it. They are going to implement this generational smoking ban almost certainly. So that is the far greater and enormous and absurd policy that is coming down the pipe. Do you think, though, that unfortunately, the generational smoking ban has almost kind of bipartisan support at this point, but do you think there's been some interesting dissent on this particular question, because it is so miserable, by which I mean the pubs, garden smoking ban and so on. There's been at least two opinion pieces in The Guardian saying it was a bad idea, which is pretty incredible by their standards. Yeah. And also, you look at the polls, yes, it's got majority support, as there is for banning lots of things when you ask people point blank. But you asked, there was a poll before the election with YouGov, which basically asked people to kind of choose out of a selection of issues what they think the role of government is, what should be the priority of government. Banning things like smoking and vaping came more or less dead last in that.
Yeah, yeah. They're not priorities for anyone. I mean, and opinion polls are worthless.
Is there room for pushback, I guess, or for some of the arguments against it, that it's regressive, that it's
the pub trade presumably is going to go all out lobbying against this. And politicians do always pretend to support pubs, you know, even if they only turn up once every 5 years to have a pint pull for them. Yeah. So you think that the pub trade will have some traction here, and it's not like 2007 when the pub trade was effectively split down the middle quite cleverly by the anti-smoking groups, who said, well, if you don't support, you know, a level playing field here, in other words, a total ban, then all these private members clubs are going to, and indeed wet pubs, are going to take your customers. So that got the big pub co's in favour of a complete ban. This time I can't see how the anti-smoking groups can do that. So there should be a lot of resistance from them. It was good to see someone like David Mitchell make a very, very strong case against it, using the same kind of arguments I was using. And the stuff, this thing that Starmer said a few months ago about he's going to tread more lightly on people's lives is just going to constantly come back to haunt him, isn't it? You know? So, I mean, not that David Mitchell is some massive authoritarian communist or anything, but he's left-leaning, for sure. And as you say, there's been one or two other pieces in The Guardian and elsewhere, I mean, across the board, really, people going, you know, I love the nanny state, but this is a step too far, you know, which makes a change from the usual, you know, disingenuous stuff about I hate the nanny state. But so we shall see. I mean, I don't know. I don't know why he would pick this fight so early, unless he's a genuine ideologue, which is kind of worse. I don't know.
And not just limited to that, we should say, as we transition onto other issues. It was interesting that in the days after that big controversy about the pub beer garden smoking ban came through, that you had Lucy Powell, the Labour front bench, on the radio, who just unprompted starts talking about the scourge of vaping. i.e. the most successful smoking reduction technology ever invented, which was telling. But unless you've got particular views on that, shall we go through some of the other
ones? I'd be worried they might be thinking about maybe banning vaping indoors or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there doesn't need to be any rhyme or reason to the stuff. They just want to do things. They just want to ban things. So that would be...
Wes Streeting's very anti-vaping as well.
He's very anti-vaping. You just don't know. They haven't come out with any concrete proposals. But, I mean, all the signals are bad, aren't they? Mm-hmm. It's pretty desperate. If they ban smoking outdoors... You know, we always go for a pint generally after recording this. You smoke, I don't. And so we go somewhere where, you know, you can smoke. And if we couldn't smoke, I'm not sure where we'd go. We'd go somewhere, presumably. whichever the last place is in the country to smoke, the middle of the road or something, or middle of some park. Or, I don't know, around people's houses, I guess. What are the shisha bars going to do?
Yeah.
You know, at least pubs have another, their primary function is to sell alcohol, and that's not yet banned. Shisha bars are just for smoking. It's
going to have a disproportionate impact on those businesses, which makes it systemically racist.
Yeah, it'd be funny if they make an exemption for shisha just on basis of, you know, racial equality or something. There was a case for that. The shisha people nearly got an exemption from the original ban, but some fanatic in government said, nah, it's got to be everywhere.
It was so absurd that when that came in and you go up the Edgware Road and you just have empty cafes with people crowded out.
Right, which you do to this day.
But they all adapted, as did a lot of businesses during COVID. Build an outside area, spend a lot of money, and now they're getting hammered again.
Yeah.
Should we rattle through some of the other things?
Yes, which, please.
I know you want to talk a bit more detail about gambling, but there's been so much that has either already been announced in the Labour manifesto or things that have been floated in the media and elsewhere on top of the smoking ban. I'm going to reel off a bunch and you can kind of take your pick. There's already been talk of minimum unit pricing following the lead of Wales and the SNP. That's not something they've really commented upon, but that's something that could be coming down the track. Health MOTs, the idea that there's going to be these people who are going to be dispatched to weigh you at work to make sure that you're not too overweight what have you.
Public health people and politicians love these kind of ideas, don't they? Like, we need to get health into every aspect of people's lives. And if you just weigh, what do they think it's going to achieve, weighing people at work? Do they think people who are fat don't know they're fat?
And that it's, oh, it'll be fine.
What are they going to do? Weigh someone, go like, you're fat. Go, yeah, I know. Well, here's some healthy living advice. Mm-hmm. What's your healthy living advice? Eat less, exercise more. Oh, thanks.
I think the idea is that they then refer them to weight loss clinics.
They don't want to go to weight loss clinics, do they? Most people who are fat couldn't care less. I mean, they'd rather not be fat, but they don't try and do anything about it most of the time.
Under no illusions about it not being a particularly healthy lifestyle.
They don't need
choice.
Someone weighing them and saying, by the way, fatty, you should, you know, change your lifestyle. It's all such a waste of time and money. And I guess it all comes down to the idea that people, lead lifestyles that the state doesn't approve of out of ignorance in some way.
Yeah.
That they don't realize that they've got a high BMI. And if all you have to do is tell them and they'll change your ways. All you have to do is put increasingly extreme pitches on cigarette packs.
Yeah.
And eventually people will go, oh, actually, these are bad for you. I never knew. It's very patronizing and also a huge waste of money.
No, absolutely. Because the idea that any of this would work, like a voluntary scheme to people to maybe weigh them, get weighed at work, and then they get referred to something, some little clinic, and then that will solve the problem. Like, aside from anything else, it being ridiculous and nannying and authoritarian in places, particularly when you're talking about banning things in the cases of other vices, like, it's just not, it's obviously not going to solve the problem of the NHS.
Well, no.
You know,
but also,
who's
actually going to do it in practice? Which employer is going to say, right, everybody? Because there's bound to be a few fat people in any large workforce. Mm-hmm. And the boss turns up one day and says, right, we've taken advantage of this government scheme and the man from the government's going to come in and weigh you all. Everyone's going to be turning around looking at the fat people. The fat people are going to be like, this is just victimization.
Mm.
And presumably people, you know, you can't force them to be weighed. They'll just go, no, I don't want to do it. It's demeaning.
State-sanctioned fat shaming is what it is, you know, which we're not about on this podcast. Just certainly the state-sanctioned bit. Ban on junk food advertising.
Yeah, so that's now going ahead officially October next year. It's been delayed numerous times.
Is that because it'd be like really difficult to actually do because you'd have to mandate
partly.
What is this?
Yeah, I don't think they've still even got an actual list of so-called junk food. Obviously, junk food is not a legal, you know, category. So
it's largely a kind of class prejudice, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. So they've just given the responsibility to Streeting to come up with a list of, quote, less healthy food. And he'll probably exempt the stuff that, you know, Waitrose shoppers like. even though it's very fatty and sugary and salty, and includes stuff that he disapproves of. So then, yeah, partly it's been delayed because it's very hard to get a proper definition of it, but also it's been because the economy hasn't been doing very well. It's really bad for broadcasters. Companies like ITV are really struggling. So it's a kind of can that really should be kicked down the road indefinitely. But again, it just shows that Streeting and Starmer believe in this stuff. The next step, listeners, I predict, will be there'll be loads more fatty food advertising on TV after 9 o'clock. There'll be a bit more in newspapers, magazines, billboards. And Jamie Oliver et al. Will be back in a year's time saying we need to close these loopholes that allow Pizza Hut to advertise on billboards and buses and so on. It would just carry on, obviously. It'd be just like with tobacco, you know, start off banning it on TV and then before you know it, it's banned everywhere. Yeah. And these are very hard times, aren't they, Tom?
Absolutely.
Where are we going to emigrate to?
That's a good question. We could get people to send in some suggestions.
Yeah, send in some suggestions, please. Where do you think I should go to? My criteria are, needs to be English speaking.
Mm.
I'm too old to learn a new language now.
The idea of it's quite amusing. Like you have a little phrase book, a Duolingo.
Yeah, I can't do it. I only learned just one word. I was in Portugal for a week. I didn't learn one word, which is thank you, which I thought would be like grazie or grazia or something like that, because it's muchos gracias in Spanish. It's grazie in Italian. But it's nothing like that in Portugal. It's obligato.
Mm.
But that's all on that. I didn't learn hello or please or anything else.
Not even like so, two beers or whatever. Yeah,
not even that. They all spoke English. Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. So anywhere that's either English speaking or, they speak a lot of English as a foreign language. and it can't be too cold, and preferably should be very warm.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously need to be very relaxed about drinking, smoking, vaping, gambling, and all the rest of the stuff. So listeners, if you want to tell me where to go, email us at...
Or maybe the sweet spot is a kind of, laws against it, but it's not really enforced,
That's fine. I'm happy with that. I mean, it's either you have very few laws and they are enforced, or you have lots of laws and none of them are enforced. Either of those works fine. Yeah. It's only when you get lots of laws which are enforced, which is what Britain has become, except for laws like, shoplifting and things like that.
The good ones, the good laws. Should we talk a bit about gambling? I know this is something that... you particularly wanted to discuss this week. So what are the developments on the anti-gambling crusade front?
Oh, just a ridiculous study that's promoted in The Observer at the weekend, which said that online gambling specifically is holding the economy back.
Mm.
And this is from NERA. I can't remember what NERA stands for. It's an economic research consultancy. And they did some work for the Campaign for Fairer Gambling, which is Derek Webb's anti-gambling outfit. Well, one of many anti-gambling outfits. And like a lot of nanny states these days, they're really going down the sort of, what's good for the economy line. How can we save people money kind of line? Which is fair enough in a sense, because
the house always wins.
The economy is not doing very well and the government's in a huge amount of debt. But most of this stuff never really adds up. And this one certainly doesn't add up. So the basic idea was people who spend money on online gambling, if they spent the money elsewhere in the leisure industry, then that would be better for the economy. Sort of a multiplier effect theory. Multiplier effect stuff is usually nonsense. It's usually self-serving. People, various industries will go, for every pound we spend, another £8 is created in the economy. This stuff is almost impossible to work out. The Olympics, people often talk about the multiplier effect for the Olympics. It's rubbish. The Olympics always costs countries more money than it gets in. Anyway. But they're not even really talking about multiplier effects. They're just talking about supposedly, and I don't believe this for a second, but according to the study, only 2.5% of online gambling companies' income gets spent as wages. I'd be very surprised if that's true. It's an extremely small amount. I mean, Denise Coates at Bet365 alone must probably account for more than 2.5%. Anyway, let's go with it. And they say that these other areas in the leisure sector, they pay out about 38%. Of their income as wages. And therefore, it's better for the economy to spend money in, let's say, the restaurant sector, because they employ more people and then the employees spend their money. whereas hardly produces any wages, and so there's fewer people to spend the money. Believe it or not, they genuinely seem to believe that unless money is given to people as wages, it just disappears. Mm-hmm. So they say, well, the online gambling companies, they spend a lot of money on advertising, which is true, they do. They have a lot in profits. They reckon the post-tax profit is 27%, which I don't believe either. But anyway, they make a lot of profit. They pay a lot of tax, which is true. And they spend a lot of money on marketing. So they just don't count that as money that in some way goes back into the economy. So all this money they spend on marketing somehow disappears.
Because it's tainted by their nefarious activities.
Well, not even that. They just ignore it for some reason. Like as if the marketing industry don't employ anybody themselves.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't end up in the hands of football clubs and broadcasters and things. And, you know, taxes. Yeah, they pay a lot of tax. And maybe, you know, having companies pay a lot of tax probably isn't great for the economy. But it can't be denied that it goes to public sector workers who then spend the money. I mean, it's a demented way of looking at things anyway. I mean, the very idea that the government should kind of clamp down on businesses that have lower multiplier effects, that in itself is a horrible idea because it would lead to some sort of weird buy British kind of campaign. Mm-hmm. And you'd be using state coercion to force people to spend money in certain industries. Whereas that's obviously not the point of the economy. The point of having an economy is that people can choose what to spend their money on and they can spend money on what they want to spend it on. Also, they never seem to consider the possibility that if you get rid of online gambling, which is essentially the counterfactual here, people will spend money just on normal gambling.
Yeah.
That never comes in. That's not considered to be a realistic casinos, substitute. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, people go to museums. It's like, don't you think they might spend it on horse racing and go to betting shops?
Or just much sketchier websites, presumably.
No, yeah, they don't consider the unlicensed sector either. So it's just a demented report. And I can't believe that Nira would, that whatever they got paid to do this report was really not enough. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that is the latest junk economics in the nanny state. I wrote about it for the Critic, folks, if people want to read about that
in a bit more detail.
It's ludicrous how they can get away with it.
But it is one of these areas where even people who are pretty liberal on a lot of lifestyle things start to bristle a little bit. We've had a few
gambling
is one of those things that gets them, and I suppose it's one thing which over the course of the past decade or two is something which, particularly in terms of online gambling, in terms of the presence of betting shops, is something which is a lot more kind of visible than it used to be. We never got our super casino from Tony Blair, but nevertheless you have seen at the very least a more visible sort of gambling industry.
Not bookies anymore.
No, that's true.
There's less than 6,000 bookies now. They used to be not that long ago, 9,000. Mm-hmm. They just collapsed after the fixed odds betting terminals were clamped down on. And probably a lot of people would say, good, I don't like bookies. Mm-hmm. But that's just the country we live in now, isn't it?
But I suppose the point I make is that, you know, it is an advertiser on almost, you know, it's all over the Premier League. It's on every football team shirt, some way, shape or form. So it's very visible. It's a very big industry. And yet, what is the scale of the problem that we're actually talking about here? Because one would expect, if you listen to the campaigners and if you looked at how much this industry seems to have proliferated in some ways, at the very least, that we would have surely a huge problem with this.
Well, I think didn't we talk a few weeks ago about the Gambling Commission's new made-up figure of problem gamblers? So for 25 years, we've believed, based on a lot of surveys, that problem gambling rate is about 0.4% of the population. And then in the last few months, the Gambling Commission started using their very, very flawed online survey to make out it's 2.5%, which would be really quite high and be kind of not far off Las Vegas levels of problem gambling. I guess they've managed to inflate that figure. But in practice, the problem is real, obviously. But to be quite frank with you, most problem gamblers are just young men who grow out of it. That's the reality of it. You know, not many of them continue being problem gamblers long term, or ever end up being one of these characters you see in the paper who's, you know, lost their house, wife, and started mugging old ladies for £10 notes so they can stick them on red in a casino. Yeah, I mean it's more visible. Yeah, apparently there is quite a lot of gambling advertising, but as a sort of quote public health issue, it's more visible just because you've got these bloody campaign groups going on about it all the time. You've got all the public health groups who, as we've discussed before, can see this massive pot of money coming from the gambling levy and are all over it. Julian Morn lost his case, by the way. I can't remember if we gave an update on that, but you remember the Good Law Project was going after Gamble Aware? I say case, I think he just wrote a snotty letter to the charity commission, but the charity commission basically told him to sling his hook. And he then moaned about the fact that they'd replied very quickly. Or was that a complaint against the IA? I forget about all the failed campaigns.
There's so many to keep track. As he said, he's going to move away from litigation now.
I wish he'd move away from England.
No, exactly. Well, either you can immigrate or he can. You might end up in the same place.
Yeah, it's me
or him. You know.
Yeah, we'll both end up in the Algarve.
Where have they got windmills? He lives in a windmill, doesn't he? So he could go to like the...
He lives near me as it is. He's down in Sussex in a windmill. I'm not quite sure which windmill. There's a few windmills around.
You've been slowly kind of working it out, process of elimination. Listeners, if you've seen Jolene roaming around near his windmill, please let us know.
Baseball cap. That's baseball bat.
That's sounding much more threatening than I intended it to. Please help us find this.
Leave him alone, motherfucker. Leave him alone.
Before we finish, Chris, we touched briefly on the tobacco and vapes bill, but I just want to return to it quickly in terms of what you see the prospects for that, and also just a reminder of how crazy a policy this is. I mean, I was, because you were away during the whole pub garden smoking ban thing, I was getting a lot of your off-cut media appearances, you know, so I was having to refresh my memory, reading your reports and so on. And I was just reminded again of how the fact that we're wedded to this mental policy of phased-in smoking prohibition. You know, I believe the only nation to attempt it in the modern era is Bhutan, who had to reverse it a few years later.
And the Islamic State, to be fair.
That's true. They did do that. And
the best countries.
And they had some successes. People don't like to talk about the positives when it comes to the caliphate, but, you know, there were some public health benefits. What are the prospects for it? I mean, we know it's going to happen in some form, not least because that handful of Tory MPs who voted against it, I think I've worked it out that the vast majority of them got wiped out.
They
were disproportionately affected, shall we say, Tory wipeout from what I can tell. But when are we likely to see that coming down the pipe, do you think?
I don't know. I don't think it'll take long. I suppose once Wes Streeting has added all his bells and whistles to it, I suppose, and made it distinctively Labour, sometime in the next 12 months, I guess. And then it'd be enforced in the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. I think kind of in a way it's a bit of a side issue. I mean, our outdoor smoking ban is way more damaging than the prohibition, certainly in the short to medium term. I mean, it's just not going to have any impact, is it, for quite a few years? Because obviously people just get older people to buy their fags for them. And cigarettes are getting so expensive that what the legal market looks like will become just increasingly irrelevant. You know, the actual price of a pack of cigarettes now is basically £5 in a lot of places. It's not hard. We're just like Australia now, where you walk into a shop, as long as it's a slightly down market corner shop, you go in there and say, give me a pack of your cheaper cigarettes. They'll pull out a brand like Manchester. And this is now something I'm seeing quite a bit of. So if they're going to keep on hiking up the price of cigarettes way above inflation, which they, I'm sure, will do, then in a way the prohibition won't really matter, because so much of the market will be illicit anyway. And the same with vapes. About a third of the disposable vape market is already illicit, despite the fact that there isn't that much regulation of them. You ban them again, we'll be like Australia. This is the crazy thing. We've got this perfect warning from the other side of the world about this is what happens if you put up the price of cigarettes way beyond what people can afford, ban vapes. We know what happens. They're now into triple figures for tobacco firebombings now in Victoria. And you would think...
become a kind of gangland, like, area.
Oh, massively.
Yeah. This isn't just shops selling it under the counter. There's a whole kind of...
No, people who used to be selling Class A drugs are selling cigarettes because there's more money in it. And we have this warning. And the crazy thing is, well, there's two crazy things about it. Firstly, British politicians either not paying attention to what's happening in Australia or just don't care. And secondly, like, none of this is making any Australian politician think, maybe we should row back some of this stuff. Maybe it's not working.
It's got a bit out of hand.
Like, do we really need to sort of normalise firebombings and incredible levels of criminality, smuggling and violence when you could just let people smoke?
Yeah.
Do you mean? You could just let people smoke and vape. Would it be that bad if some people smoked and vaped?
Is it more important to take that, whatever it is in Australia, say it's the same as here, like 13% of the population, to stop them from smoking? Is that more important than avoiding near constant firebombing of businesses?
But people don't row back, do they? Maybe they think it's like this around the rest of the world. It's kind of like, well, everyone has firebombings, don't they? I don't know. It's so hard.
If you're going to have firebombings, you might as well have them for good public health reasons.
Yeah.
So grounds for optimism.
I'm not moving in Australia, let's put it that way. No. But there was never much danger of me doing that.
grounds for optimism is embrace the black market,
yeah,
but not too far with the fire, with the old fire bombings, or move abroad.
Or both.
And on that point, I think we should end it. Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.